Hi, this is Ricky Lee Jones. You're listening to Everything Fab 4 on Salon.com.
Welcome to Everything Fab 4, a new podcast focused on fun and intelligent stories about the Beatles. I'm your host, Ken Womack, music culture columnist for Salon.com and a Beatles scholar and historian. No other band, or popular phenomenon for that matter, has enjoyed the global impact of the Beatles. They are part of our human fabric. They created an enduring music that brings people together, and just about everyone has their own Beatles story to tell. Some that are surprisingly deep and unexpected. With each episode, we'll be featuring a new guest to share their Fab Four journey, along with amazing theme music from Black Rabbit. Remember, it's a Beatles world, and everybody has a story.
My mother said, "You've got to have an escort," but all my friends were at school. She said, "I know, I'll call George Harrison." Although I was, you know, people knew who I was profoundly impressed with the Beatles. I was madly in love with all of them, but I think I was more in love with George than any of them. And suddenly, there he was, standing in the hall. I couldn't believe it. And I couldn't think of what to say. It was surreal. The whole thing was absolutely surreal.
Today's guest is English actress Hayley Mills. The daughter of Sir John Mills and Mary Hayley Bell, and the younger sister of actress Juliet Mills, Hayley began her acting career as a child and was hailed as a prodigy. In 1959, she won the BAFTA Award for Most Promising Newcomer for her performance in the British crime drama Tiger Bay. In 1960, she earned the Academy Juvenile Award for Disney's Pollyanna, and in 1961, a Golden Globe Award for New Star of the Year in the actress category. During her early career, she appeared in six films for Walt Disney, including her career-making dual role as twins Susan and Sharon in the Disney film The Parent Trap. In the film, she famously sings Let's Get Together as a duet with herself. Her 1961 performance in Whistle Down the Wind, an adaptation of the novel written by her mother, also saw Mills nominated for a BAFTA Award for Best British Actress. At one point, the Hollywood A-list actress Mills was offered the title role in Lolita by Stanley Kubrick, but her father turned it down. "I wish I had done it," she said in 1962. "It was a smashing film." In the mid-1960s, she appeared in her last film with Disney, the hit comedy, That Darn Cat. During her six-year run at Disney, Mills emerged as the most popular child actress of her era. Critics took great pleasure in noting the irony that America's favorite child star was, in fact, quite British and very ladylike. In 2021, she published her memoirs, Forever Young, and oh yeah, she happened to know the Beatles. Welcome, Hayley Mills. So tell us, when did you first hear this thing called the Beatles?
Oh, I don't remember the first time I heard them. They were just suddenly in the world, you know, transforming everything. And their music was everywhere. I can't be that specific. I wish I could. I know the first time I met them was I met them at the London Palladium for the first time. I met them twice at the London Palladium when they were appearing. The second time I mentioned in the book was when Judy Garland was also on the bill.
So was the Palladium show the very famous one where the Daily Mirror came up with the phrase Beatlemania and the fans were in the streets afterwards?
Quite possibly, yeah.
I mean, that was that would have been October 1963.
Well, yeah, I mean, they hadn't gone to America by that time.
Well, then that was definitely October 1963, which was, you know, there are two phases, right, of Beatlemania. And the first is British Beatlemania, naturally, which is ignited probably during the summer with She Loves You, but also with that Palladium show in October 1963. And then, as you just noted, American Beatlemania in the spring of, in February 1964. So maybe if you can share some of your memories of being at the Palladium and seeing them perform live.
Yeah, that was amazing. And they did a sort of high-flying act, which was rather extraordinary. I think they came down on harnesses, you know, the Kirby flying apparatus, playing their instruments. They were just so charismatic, all of them, and so wonderful to look at. Their music was so unique. It was very exciting to see them all, you know, standing in front of you. They were all four of them were so special and different, weren't they?
Do you remember hearing songs like She Loves You and I Want to Hold Your Hand?
Of course.
Is it true that you have a 10-year-old grandson who is quite the Beatles fan?
Oh, huge. Yes, his name's Harry. And he's my son Crispian's second son. He's got Crispian has two sons. Keshava is 13. They both love the Beatles. But Harry is the real aficionado. He really knows. He could go on Wheel of Fortune or something about the Beatles.
How is it that that a kid like Harry makes the discovery of the Beatles, do you think? Well, how does something like that happen? I mean, they're 50 plus, I mean, they're almost 60 years old in terms of going to the studio for the first time.
Well, his father, Crispian, is a musician and has a wonderful band called Kula Shaker. And Crispian has made sure that his sons have a very eclectic taste in music. So they know all about the Beatles and all about the great bands of the 60s and 70s. So they're very, they have very Catholic tastes, but they really do know the 60s and 70s very well.
It is remarkable, isn't it, how that music seems to find an audience with folks, you know, several generations hence. Because that wouldn't have been the same, right, for us back in, you know, it's not like you in the early 60s would have been just excited to hear music from the jazz age.
Yeah. Mind you, I did love the music from the jazz age. And I loved Frank Sinatra and I loved, you know, the singers of that time. This is what, you know, this is one of the reasons why the Beatles were so astonishing, because they were suddenly the music for the young generation. And they were ours. Their songs were about us, about our lives and what we were experiencing being young at that time. They represented us. They represented us very well. You know, we identified with them. And they still identify, you know, they still exemplify really that period. Both my sons, my youngest son's got three much younger children, and I know that he will be absolutely certain to indoctrinate them.
Whatever it is that people connected with in 1963, 64, obviously they're still connecting. And I know we have some great Beatles stories to talk about later where you connect with them, but can you tell me and our listeners about how you became an entertainer? What was it that brought you into that world?
Oh, gosh, well, luck. Luck, being in the right place at the right time. My father was the actor John Mills, And when I was born, he was already a star. He'd been a star. He was a star all his life, a movie star. And my life was full of actors coming in and out of the house. And that was the world that I grew up in and was most familiar with. And then one day, the film director, J. Lee Thompson, who was a great friend of my father's, came down to the farm we were living on in the middle of Sussex to talk to my dad about a film that he was preparing called Tiger Bay. He wanted my dad to be in it. It was starring a German film star called Horst Buchholst, and he was looking for a young boy to be in the film, and he'd looked everywhere, apparently, all over the place, seen lots and lots of these young boys. But, you know, during that visit, he saw me doing TV commercials, just singing jingles and messing around and being a bit stupid, really. And he got the idea of changing it from a boy to a girl right there, you know, at lunch. He said, "How would you like to be in a film?" And I said, "Yeah, I'd love to be," whatever that means. I mean, I knew what it meant, of course, but... And so that's how it happened. I mean, if he'd met my father in London, he would never have met me, and I probably wouldn't be talking to you now.
It was that simple, huh? It turned on that dime.
It did. It does. Life does, doesn't it?
Now, you were, of course, as a person who had grown up with actors, this was a world with which you were familiar, right?
Yeah.
So you were prepared for it, but then at the same time you weren't. And one of the things that's so powerful in your book is how you discuss the highs of this experience. And then, of course, there was a trauma too, right?
Well, of course, you know, it turned my family's life upside down. Nobody expected me to be, you know, suddenly... to have a career at the age of 12. I was just going to my boarding school, and life was very well organized, with my father working and my mother writing, and my sister Juliet and I were at boarding school. My brother Jonathan wasn't. He was just at prep school, day school. And then suddenly this bombshell happened. You know, my mother had to run around being with me, and that meant she couldn't be with my dad. And then, you know, it all got much more serious. Instead of just being a one-off fun thing to do, one movie, I was signing a contract. And initially the contract was for 7 years, but they felt that was too much. And then it was whittled down to 5 years. So all in all, I made 6 pictures for Walt Disney. And it was difficult, very, very difficult decision for them to make. I mean, I wouldn't like to have had to make that decision for my 2 boys when they were 12. You don't know what your child is actually going to turn into. You don't know what their talents are, really. Who knows? You know, so they had to make a very, very difficult decision. So, I mean, I was keen. I wanted to act. And I didn't know, of course, what the future would bring. And nobody did. Nobody does.
And you were experiencing this unusual brand of fame very quickly during this period. In fact, which will be, you know, foreshadowing here. Important to your understanding of the Beatles later, but it even affected you at boarding school, right?
Yes, yes, absolutely. Yes, things sort of got a bit skewed. I didn't think anything of it. Well, I did. I mean, it was great, but I think it was more that the adults in the school thought that I was going to be immediately turn into a brat with a huge, huge, big head. So they felt they had to keep me under their thumbs a bit more than was maybe necessary. But There we are. It was okay. And I ended up being asked to leave that school at 15 because I was coming and going all the time, you know, and making and disrupting things in the classroom. So they thought it was better if I made myself scarce. So I ended up going to a finishing school in Switzerland. It was all odd, you know, because when I was a child, I was in England or I was in Switzerland. And so I didn't have my friends around me. I didn't have people who shared my experiences. And that was one of the things that was difficult, being cut off from my friends and people who knew what I was talking about. It would have been different if I'd stayed in Hollywood. But I think it was probably better in the long run that I didn't. And I just went back to England and tried to lead a normal life.
When we return, we'll find out exactly what that normal life entailed for Haley. And it even included a date, that's right, with a Beatle. We're back with Haley Mills.
You know, when people think about Hollywood today, they think about corporations and these big conglomerates that run everything and that sort of thing. Back then, you describe it in your book as a kind of family business. What did that entail? How did it feel different for folks, you know, who don't have the time machine to go back to the early 1960s and understand that? How did the family business manifest itself as opposed to today's big corporate conglomerate?
Really, I can only talk about, you know, the Disney studios. They were much smaller. And I don't know exactly how many sound stages there were, but I know I could get around them very easily when I stole the postboy's bicycle. And the other thing was that everyone seemed to know each other. Everyone knew what was going on the lot. All the films were Disney films. And the boss was very much part of life. Walt Disney himself was wandering around the studios and going onto the sound stages and watching the filming and talking to the actors and the crew. And he knew people's names. It was his studio. And he knew exactly what was going on everywhere. He was intimately involved in how every film was shot. When you go onto a great big studio and you don't see the boss, there's that slight sort of empty feeling. You know, it's a bit like being at a big party without the host. And I went back to work at Disney a few years later, and I did three sequels of The Parent Trap for television. And of course, Walt himself had died quite a few years before. And Michael Eisner was there, and, you know, good boss, but I never saw him. He wasn't that kind of a boss. He was very remote, and Disney was getting bigger and bigger by that time. So I was extremely lucky to have that experience and be there at that time, you know, when Hollywood was full of big film stars. And it was really before television kicked in and changed everything, changed the feeling in Hollywood.
What was Walt Disney like?
He was everything you would hope him to be. He was charming, warm, gentle. Basically, you know, he liked simple pleasures. He had a wonderful sense of humor, a real twinkle in his eye. He was really interested in children. He loved to know what they thought about things. He listened when they spoke. Well, I loved him. He took my family and I to Disney Studios. He turned up at our condo outside the Chateau Marmont and drove us in his car to Disneyland, and we stayed there for the weekend. And he went on all the rides with us and had such a ball. He had an absolute ball. He loved it. Yeah, he died much too young.
You know, in your story, one of the aspects that you share so candidly is about the challenges of trying to keep up your appearance and to please this audience that's a massive audience that's interested in you. What was the struggle like in terms of being able to do that?
Well, this is one of the reasons that I wrote this book, Ken, because I realized that my struggles, I mean, I didn't realize it at the time, which made me feel really cut off from everybody. But I realized writing it that it was, because what I was writing about was, I was writing about everybody else's experience as well. The experience of facing, of going through adolescence and leaving childhood behind when life was much more simple. And you knew who you were and you were in the moment and it was spontaneous and things were simple and easy. And then it got more and more and more complicated. You start asking questions, the way you look, the way your body looks, your face, you compare yourself to other people, you're shy, you don't know what to talk about, you don't know what's going on in the world, you haven't really found out yet. And you feel a tremendous responsibility to be a grown up and you don't know how to do it. And it's really quite frightening. And I think we all get a bit, we feel we're shut up in ourselves when we're going through adolescence. And it's very difficult to explain how we're feeling. And particularly the kids today, I think, and during this awful lockdown, all this horrible business with the pandemic, is people have been cut off from each other. And that's kind of awful. Cruelty, really. We're very social creatures. We need each other. And I don't think social media is the answer. I don't think that takes the place of real human contact at all, not remotely. And it's not genuine either. I don't think it's real. It's not real. People don't project their real selves. No, there's nothing to be meeting up with your friends and hanging out together and chatting and, you know, sharing your stories, how you're and your feelings.
That's a great observation about social media, right? This place where often people are just trying to show us their ideal selves, where they have these great vacations, right? And all of these fun, inspired, energetic moments when, of course, life isn't always like that. And
that's right.
And reading about you as a young girl and your efforts to try to please so many people, like controlling your body image and you even at one point were bulimic. Is that correct?
Right. Yeah, I was. Yeah. I know that's, you know, and of course, I thought I was the first person to really think of it. Although I did meet this jockey called Edward Hyde, who told me, was it Eddie Hyde? Oh, wait a minute. Anyway, he told me that he used to eat grass to make himself throw up. And I thought, wow, that's the answer. Because when you're growing, you know, you become obsessed with food because you're growing and you need nourishment for your growing body. And so it's an awful battle between what your body knows you need food to build the bones and the body that you're going to have, hopefully, for a very long time, for the rest of your life. And at the same time, you don't want the plumpness, you know, you don't want this baby fat. You don't, you know, you hate it, you hate it. And so it's this awful battle between the wanting the food and needing to get rid of it and hating yourself in the middle of it. It's real mental torture, all that. And my heart goes out to, I don't know, is it mostly girls that do this, or do boys do it as well? They probably do. But it's a horrible place to be.
So the camera really does add 10 pounds, huh?
Oh, it adds quite a few pounds. Yes, yeah, it does. Yeah.
And I suppose there's just the strangeness, especially at a young age, of seeing yourself on screen and having to think about that person and how she's going out all over the world, right? Your fame is interesting, and the way you experience it. I wonder if you could tell the story of your date with George Harrison. How did that come about?
Well, I had met George at one of these London Palladium nights, and my parents and I had been invited to a charity event just outside London in a town called Henley, and the idea was to the charity was the Red Cross, and we were actor called Richard Todd, who organized this every year for the Red Cross. And you went down and you went and watched a movie at the local cinema, and people bought tickets because there were celebrities there and all that sort of thing. So anyway, we would go. And my mother said, you've got to have an escort. But all my friends were at school. So she said, I know, I'll call George Harrison. I still can't get over her doing that. She called him up and asked him if he would take me to this charity event. And he said yes, which was, you know, although I was, you know, people knew who I was profoundly impressed with the Beatles. I was madly in love with all of them. But I think I was more in love with George than any of them. George and Ringo were my particular favorites. And suddenly there he was standing in the hall. I couldn't believe it. And I couldn't think of what to say. And he drove me in his black E-type Jaguar down to Henley. It was surreal. The whole thing was absolutely surreal. And when we got to the cinema, we were nearly stabbed to death by the girl screaming and trying to get his autograph. You know, they kind of seemed to be coming at us with their pens, like they were going to get our eyes out. And all through watching the film, people were leaning on you, you know, with their elbows on your shoulders and their stomach in your face. And people were literally crawling up the aisle with their autograph books in their mouth to get at George. But anyway, it was a unforgettable evening. And then he drove me home in his wonderful black E-type Jaguar. And it was very, very late. And when we got back to the house, my father opened the door and said, we'll ask George in for some scrambled eggs. So we went down to the kitchen and my father cooked scrambled eggs. I'd never seen him cook scrambled eggs before in my life. And then at one point, George jumped up and said, well, I'm sorry, but I've got to go now because Ringo and I are moving house and we've got a police escort. And it was 4:30 in the morning and off he rushed. And years and years and years later, I met George again with his wife, Olivia, at the Chelsea Flower Show. And we were laughing about that night, remembering it. And he said, do you know, Ailey, he said, it's one of the things that was one of my favorite memories. He said, one of my most special memories is having scrambled eggs cooked for me by John Mills at 4:00 in the morning, which was such a sweet thing to say because he met everybody who's anybody. But he was a fan of my father's.
And he was probably a fan, right, of having that human experience, as you were describing earlier.
Yes.
What is it, do you think? Well, first of all, why? You've mentioned that car a couple of times. That must have been one impressive car, huh?
No, it was. It was. You should Google it. Have a look what an E-type Jaguar circa 1960 looked like. It was incredible.
And then what kind of things did you guys talk about when you're taking this car trip out to Henley?
I do remember talking about very ordinary things. One time he said he wanted to go bowling, which we both wanted to do, but he couldn't do things like that. He was too famous. He hadn't hit America yet, so that hadn't really gone kind of totally ballistic. But he was certainly the Beatles were huge at that point in England and Europe.
What an incredible statement you made a moment ago too about Ringo and George requiring a police escort just to move.
Yeah, had to move in the wee small hours of the morning.
That's really staggering. If you think about it, it illustrates how strange and remarkable that quality of fame was. So when you're with George and you're at the cinema, did they want your autograph too?
No. No, they were just kind of standing on me. No.
What was it, trying to explain to my students these days this kind of response that the Beatles achieved, particularly during that period in 1964 and in those first few years in the United States, the screaming, the kind of emotional response. Is that something you could understand when you saw it happening, or did it seem foreign to you?
No, completely understood it. Completely. I mean, I was at the Hollywood Bowl when they appeared there. And of course, you know, it's a well-known story that the noise was so enormous. It was so loud. It was so intense that, and with every single person in that enormous auditorium was screaming at the top of their voices all the way through the Beatles set. And of course, they heard nothing. They were so hysterically excited about seeing them that they didn't hear anything. And there was this helicopter overhead, hovering quite low over the stadium, and there was a rope ladder hanging from it, and people hanging on the rope ladder taking pictures. I mean, talk about risking life and limb. So you've got the sound of the blades of the helicopter and the scream and the thudding of its engine, and the screaming, but it could not hear a single thing. It was crazy.
So full disclosure, were you one of the screamers?
Well, sort of, but not as much. No, because I really did want to hear them. I'm sure I gave the odd scream, but certainly when they walked out, that was very, very exciting moment. They were so charming. You just had to love them. Everybody loved them. You know, and I remember initially my parents, my mother particularly, was, a bit guarded. She wasn't won over immediately, but pretty soon afterwards, you know, she became a big fan too. And I don't remember meeting anybody who didn't love the Beatles. And the funny thing was, in England at that time, before they got really huge, even in America, that very straight, staid English men, middle-aged to getting on men, suddenly started combing their grey hair forward and giving themselves a Beatle haircut.
Everything Fab Four is presented by Salon.com, the premier news, politics, innovation, and arts website. For more information about the podcast, visit everythingfab4.com, where you can learn more about our podcast and my latest Beatles-related book, John Lennon 1980, The Last Days in the Life. The Everything Fab Four theme song, Seize the Day, is provided courtesy of Black Rabbit, the high-octane Beatles cover band and innovative psychedelic rock project from Rockaway Beach, Queens, in New York City. Like what you heard today on Everything Fab Four? Be sure to subscribe, give us a rating, and recommend the show to your friends. Plus, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at EF4 Podcast. Distributed by Salon, Everything Fab Four is a Wonderwall production with editing and post-production assistance from music industry and communication students at Monmouth University. Remember, it's a Beatles world, and everyone has a story.